From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
President Trump's promise to remove U.S. troops from Syria set off a firestorm earlier this month among the media and politicians in Washington. But what would a larger peace offensive look like in the Middle East if conducted by the U.S. or its ally, Israel? RT's reporter Paula Slyer sat down with Palestine's Prime Minister Mohammed Shtayyeh and discussed the U.S. role in the region. This is RT journalist Paula Slyer.
I have the Palestinian Prime Minister Mohammed Shtayyeh. Thank you very much for joining us here on RT and for hosting us in Ramallah.
My pleasure.
The American President Donald Trump, by withdrawing his troops from Syria, what do you, as the Palestinian Prime Minister, take as the message from the American administration?
American President is very unpredictable. He says one thing, he does the other, and he keeps changing his mind. We hope that if the United States is really leaving the scene, it should leave the area in peaceful, not in chaos. And I hope that United States, even though the claim was that this has not been coordinated with the Israelis, whether or not, obviously, the American president can be decisive. And if that happens, we hope that the American president will be decisive on the issue that comes to Palestinians living out of occupation, Palestinians living in freedom, Palestinians living in two states, Palestinian living in free and independent sovereign state. Now, unfortunately, that the president has taken us into a totally different direction, but the message from Syria is that if the American president wants something, it can happen. The problem is what is he's doing is not does not fulfill our national aspirations.
Do you think America's withdrawal from the Middle East is beneficial for the Palestinians?
Well, look, yes, by all means, because I think with the new emerging political reality and living under monopoly, one power, this is a very unhealthy situation. And I think the Russian engagement in the Syrian affair and that Russian Federation has a presence on the Mediterranean, I think it does counterbalance all what is happening in the region. And I think it is very important to really break the American monopoly over the region.
Jared Kushner, the American president's advisor, is heading to the region. We know that the Palestinian Authority does not support the so-called deal of the century being put forward by Trump and that you boycotted the donors conference in Bahrain. Do you have details of what exactly is entailed in the so-called deal of the century?
We know the economic chapter of this deal has been revealed in Manama, Bahrain. It does show that the whole of this issue has not been really serious at all, on one hand. On the other hand, on the political chapter, we don't know what is in it, but we know what is not in it. What is not in it is two states. What is not in it is Jerusalem as the capital of the state of Palestine. What is not in it is refugees. And what is not in it is 67 borders and the removal of the Jewish settlements from the occupied Palestinian territory. Now, for us, if these all things that has been agreed upon by the Israelis to be an issue of negotiations, if they are not there in the ultimate deal, then the ultimate deal is really about nothing. Luckily, United States has no partners in this deal. They couldn't find a European partner, they couldn't find Arab partner, and they couldn't find any Palestinian partner. So, in the same way that the economic chapter has been declared dead at birth, I think this political chapter will be born dead as well.
What about the argument that Trump's deal is actually thinking out of the box, trying to bring the two sides together and leaving the most difficult issues to the end? Because you've already tried to negotiate with these issues and there's no progress.
We sat down with the Israelis. We negotiated Jerusalem. We negotiated settlements. We negotiated 67 borders. We negotiated Jerusalem. We couldn't reach an agreement. So these are the issues on the table. Now, we cannot come to another political chapter just simply to extend the interim period again. The interim period has been long enough. It started in 1993 and today we are in 2019. We cannot make the interim permanent, and all what Israel is hoping to see is an interim solution is a permanent solution. We are ready to sit on the table if there is a clear terms of reference. if the issues on the negotiating table are issues that fits neatly within the aspirations of the Palestinian people.
The million-dollar question, what needs to happen for there to be peace between Israelis and Palestinians?
Five issues. One, clear terms of reference, which has never been there. Second, good intentions. It has been never there. Third, confidence-building measures to stop settlements. It has not been there. Fourth, honest broker. It has not been there. United States is not an honest broker. And fifth is a time frame. It has not been there. Terms of reference, it means that we need the only applicable terms of reference to the Palestinian-Israeli conflict is international law. Confidence building measure, Israel has employed confidence destruction measures. The intentions, Israel never had the intention to end its occupation. The honest broker was only the United States. The United States is in strategic alliance with Israel and it is not qualified to be an honest broker. Time frame, the whole process started October 1991. Today we are in 2019. That's 28 years of negotiations. It is not possible to continue under this sort of paradigm. You need a serious paradigm shift from bilateral to multilateral.
Israel's been holding elections. Do you think anything new is going to come forward?
Well, we know one thing, which is Netanyahu is not anymore going to be the prime minister, obviously. It doesn't mean that who is going to replace him is something that we are in favor for.
That's what I want to ask you. Would you prefer the former army chief Benny Gantz to Prime Minister Netanyahu? Is there somebody on the Israeli side you would prefer to work with?
Well, I prefer the Prime Minister of Israel to be somebody who is ready to stand up and say he or she is ready to end occupation that has occurred on the Palestinian territories since 1967.
What happens if ultimately there's some kind of unity government in Israel, a kind of power sharing between Netanyahu and Gantz? Is that an option for you to work with?
The issue for us is not the formation of the Israeli government. The issue is the content, the political content. What is it that they are offering us? We are not on the supply side. We are not on the offering side. Israel has to say that it is ready for talks to end occupation. We are resisting this occupation. We are at the resistance level. We are occupied people. We are not the ones who make offers. We are not the ones who make compromises. It is Israel has to make an offer to the Palestinians, and we are ready to deal with any serious offer on two states, end of occupation, illegality of settlements, that somebody in Israel has to stand up to abide by international law and United Nations resolutions vis-a-vis Palestine, Israel.
Netanyahu has been talking with Saudi Arabia. Is this good for you?
I don't think that Netanyahu has been talking with Saudi Arabia. I think it is Netanyahu tried to fabricate stories about talking to the Saudis. The Saudis stand firm and solid on their political support for Palestine, on their political support for two states, on their political support that Jerusalem is an integral part of the Palestinian territory and it is the future capital of the state of Palestine. And so therefore, all these sort of prefabricated and fabricated stories about Saudi-Israeli talks is totally untrue.
Before we discuss Russia's role, do you think there could be a role for Saudi Arabia or another country to play the role that the Americans were playing before in terms of bringing Israelis and Palestinians to the negotiating table?
Saudi Arabia, Jordan, Russia, Europe, BRICS countries, all others can come together in an international conference to really settle the Palestinian-Israeli conflict on the basis of international law and United Nations resolution. So everybody has a role to play, and we really want the peace camp in the region and internationally to be as solid as it should be. There has been an experience of multilaterals that has worked. There is a multilateral formula with Iran. Unfortunately, Trump has tried to reverse it. There has been also some sort of multilateral formulation when it comes to Syria. There are so many players that are always consulted. Even though the war in Syria is still in the last 15 minutes of the hour, we hope that this war on Syria will end very soon. But what I'm saying is that we have to move seriously from a bilateral paradigm in which United States is enjoying monopoly over the Palestinian-Israeli peace track and to widen it.
Russia's been speaking for some time about hosting an Israeli-Palestinian conference in Moscow. Is this feasible?
Well, our president announced explicitly and clearly that he is ready to engage with that. And he notified President Putin about it years ago. The Israeli Prime Minister was not ready for that. And therefore, when we challenge them with these realities, that we are ready to engage. We are ready to engage. The question is, what is on the table? What is your offer? What are you offering? Do you really have a content to offer or not? I think Netanyahu never had any content. Netanyahu just wanted to, you know, camouflage things on the basis of just as if we are talking for the sake of talking, not talking for the sake of reaching a conclusion and reaching a solution.
Russia has met with both sides, both the Israelis and the Palestinians. Do you think Moscow is uniquely placed to actually bring the sides together and make progress?
Israel has to be put under international law. Israel has to abide by international law. And I think Russia and Europe, they are the guarantors of international law at a time when the United States is trying to destroy international order that has been put in place since 1945 until today.
Let's talk about reconciliation between Hamas and Fatah. There have been efforts to try and bring the sides together, and at the same time, there continues to be political clashes. What do you think is going to happen going forward?
We proposed that we sit down and talk. We did talk. We have been talking for 12 years now. We signed 4 agreements with Hamas. Unfortunately, none of these agreements has ever been implemented by Hamas. Now, we are saying the following. Our model, our paradigm for reconciliation is based on one single thing, which is one authority. That's our model for reconciliation. Hamas' model for reconciliation is based on division of labor. They want something underground, we take the above ground. We bring the money, they spend the money. We are the government, they are the ruling party. We don't accept this. Our paradigm is not acceptable to them. Their paradigm is not acceptable to us. So our president has come with an idea that we refer things to the people. Let's go to elections. And now we are actually working to have elections very soon. The president of the Central Election Commission is going to be there next week in Gaza, and he has to come up with answer whether Hamas is ready for this or not. We are very keen about the democratic character of the Palestinian society. It's crucial for our survival to be a democratic society based on the rule of law.
What happens if Hamas wins the elections again in Gaza?
This is what democracy is about. Who won the elections, who wins the elections, we have to respect the outcome of the ballot boxes.
Hamas is supported by Iran. How significant is this?
Arab, Muslim, international players don't really interfere in the internal affairs of the Palestinian people. I think Iran can support Palestine, but I don't think it is wise for any party to support one single faction within the Palestinian political arena. That is not helpful. It doesn't help Palestine. It doesn't help anybody. So therefore, I hope that the Iranian will change their position in supporting Palestine and the Palestinians and the legitimate leadership of the Palestinian people rather than really supporting this faction or that faction.
The Palestinian Authority has been refusing to receive the monthly taxes that Israel collects on its behalf because Israel's been withkeeping money that it says goes to prisoners and families of those who have killed Israelis. Firstly, why is it important for you to pay the families of those who have killed Israelis?
Well, first of all, Palestinian prisoners, the 7,662 people who are in the Israeli prison, it's not all of them have killed Israelis. There are kids who are in jail because of throwing a stone. There are kids who have been in jail because of raising a Palestinian flag. There are people who are in jail because they protected their land, their water rights, there, and so on. So it's not everybody that who is in Israeli jail is a person who killed an Israeli or that. What do we do as responsible people? We have to take care of these people. More than that, this issue of payments to the prisoners, it's a social allowance. The man who killed 77 people in Norway is receiving social allowance. Yigal Amir, who killed Ishaq Rabin, the Israeli prime minister, is getting social allowance from the state of Israel. So why is it not possible for the Palestinians to have their own social allowance? If the Israelis don't want us to pay for the prisoners, release all of them.
Some of those prisoners did kill Israelis. So by supporting their families, are you not in a way condoning violence?
No, not at all. On the contrary, when I take care of the kids whom their father was killed by the Israelis, or when we take care of the kids by a Palestinian who is in Israeli prisons, we are accommodating these kids to be in the peace camp, in tolerance. Look at the Palestinian prisoners. One important thing, this is a very sensitive issue. Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza, we are 5 million people. 5 million, 3 million in the West Bank, 2 million in Gaza. You know how many Palestinians have been into the Israeli prison since 1967 until today? 1 million people. 1 million. So the issue of the prisoners, it does touch the heart of every Palestinian household and so on and so forth. There is a huge difference between supporting violence and that you are accommodating families of people who are victims of violence themselves, and that we take care of their kids. This is not nourishing. This is not, harboring violence. On the contrary.
What do you think about individual attacks against Israel? So, for example, a person picks up a knife and stabs an Israeli, because the Israelis argue that the Palestinian Authority encourages such acts through hate speech and incitement.
What about Israeli incitements? What about the settlers who are uprooting our trees? What about the settlers who are killing our kids? What about the checkpoints that are everywhere? What about all these aggressions that Israel is taking against our land? All these sort of things. This is where the real incitement for violence. We have to not to look at the symptoms of things. We have to look at the roots of things. The roots of all of these problems is occupation. If Israel is not happy about all what is happening here, let them leave us alone. By making serious peace, end of occupation, this is how you eliminate all these sort of phenomena.
At the moment, you get electricity and oil from Israel. You've held talks at getting it from Iraq and possibly through a third party. Do you think it's feasible and realistic that Palestine can be economically independent of Israel?
We don't have control over our borders. We have no control over our resources, but we have to mentally start a process of disengaging, because at the end of the day, if Israel mean to incorporate the Palestinian territories into that of Israel, this has been a process of a gradual annexation. Israel controls our resources, our entry points, our exit points, our international trade, and so on and so forth. But at least we started to disengage. There are so many issues that we can rely upon ourselves rather than importing it.
Donations from the Arab world have been reduced significantly. Is this something that you can overcome?
It's not from the Arab world only. Donations to Palestine has declined. There, it's not a sharp drop, but there is a significant decline. Some donors, they say that they have been with us for 28 years. There is no political process. Things are not moving. So they are not help. There are new emerging realities in the region. Yemen is there. Syria is there. Iraq is there. So we have to compete about donors' money with the rest of the region. But I think the international community, thanks to them, they are still with us. The Arab countries, Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, Qatar, Algeria, as well as European countries, Japan, Korea, China. There are so many friends for Palestine who are helping, including, of course, the Russian Federation and others. So we are not abandoned. We are not left alone.
The United States was the biggest donor of UNRWA, the United Nations Relief and Works Agency, but it no longer is, and there's cause for UNRWA to be closed down. Should UNRWA close down, how do you see the future of the Palestinian refugee situation?
United States thought by stopping its finances to UNRWA, UNRWA will die down. Fortunately, the international community has come forward and they have covered all the budget deficit of UNRWA. It's crucial for us that UNRWA continue to exist under the mandate that is offered to it by the United Nations. It has been of great help to these very poor people who are living in refugee camps. Until the issue of refugees is settled, UNRWA should continue to exist.
You have said that you won't allow Israeli forces into Area A. Now, Area A are the areas that are under Palestinian rule. This seems to be a change in language. Are you suggesting potentially that there could be a confrontation with Israel or a third intifada?
Israel should not continue violating the agreements that has been signed with us. Israel has signed an agreement with us, and Israel is not respecting any of these agreements. We cannot continue to respect that agreement unilaterally. So therefore, if for the Israelis all areas are C, for us all areas are A. And therefore, we are ready to protect whatever our domain is.
There have been clashes at the holy sites in Jerusalem, and the Israelis claim that the Palestinian Authority is making trouble, and they've arrested the PA governor of Jerusalem. How will you deal with this in the future? What is the future of the holy sites?
What is happening in Jerusalem is a war on narrative. and about narrative. Israel wants to falsify the Palestinian narrative about Jerusalem. So the Israelis, they want a Jewish narrative to dominate Jerusalem, Al-Aqsa, and all of Palestine. And therefore, us being there, we're defending the mosque, Jerusalem, and the narrative of the Palestinians, Muslims and Christians, about the holy city, about the holy land, and so on. Having said that, the solution is not about narrative. The solution is political. Having said that, the war is not religious. The solution is political. So therefore, I hope that the Israelis will realize this.
Mr. Prime Minister, just a few questions from some of our viewers. This question: do the Palestinians feel there is any hope for liberation in their lifetime? And if so, could this come about without violence?
All this sort of issue is about the will of the people. Palestinians have been struggling for 100 years and more, and we will continue to do so until we are living an independent Palestinian state. I hope it doesn't take longer. I hope it will be in our lifetime. But if not, doesn't mean the struggle is going to stop.
How do you see things in 10 years' time?
For the Palestinians, maybe not this year, maybe next year, but for sure the Palestinians will reach a time in which their kids will be free and their aspirations will be fulfilled and their political rights will be obtained, and that the whole region of the Middle East will live into a totally different region, a totally different era, and a totally different political aspirations and peace for all.
Why do you not recognize Israel as a Jewish state?
The issue is not about whether Israel is Jewish or not. The issue is that Israel is a colonial regime that should end its occupation to our territory. This is the story. It's not about whether Palestine is Islamic or a Christian country, or Israel is a Jewish or not issue. This doesn't solve the problem. The problem is political. Israel can call itself whatever they want. I have no problem with that. They can go to United Nations and say, we are going to change my name. Like any human being can go to the court and change his name or her name, Israel can go to United Nations and change its name and ask the international community, everybody, to recognize it. Why is it that Israel is only asking the Palestinians to recognize it as a Jewish state?
What are your views on a permanent peace in Palestine?
Permanent peace in Palestine is about Palestinian political rights. The moment Palestinians are going to enjoy these political rights in an independent Palestinian state on the borders of 67 with Jerusalem as its capital, with the right of refugees to return, that's where we stand. And that is where we end. And that is what we are fighting for.
And the last question, why do you want an economic disagreement with Israel? How sure are you that seeking cooperation with Egypt will benefit you in the long term?
Well, by all means. We are not saying that, you know, if Israel is ready to sit down and talk to us on state to state, we are ready to sit down and do that. But Israel is dealing with us as if we are simply a pocket on their trousers. We are just a subset of their own. And our economy has been conditioned to suit the Israeli economy. Our economy has been designed in a way, restructured in a way to serve the Israeli economy. I am here to redesign the Palestinian economy in a way to serve the Palestinian people, not to the Israeli economy. And therefore, if Israel is ready to sit down and talk to us as independent state and two states, we are ready to engage economically, because I know economic theory is very simple. It does teach us that small economies benefit from larger economy. Israel is a large economy. GDP in Israel is about $430 billion. Our GDP is $14 billion, which is really very small compared to that of Israel. This doesn't mean that we will allow the Israelis to swallow our economy. We need to resist it in a way that we will, in the future, be capable of feeding our own people from our own resources. That is where. So the issue is about integrity. The issue is not about really additional loaf bread. The issue is not about living under five stars occupation. The issue is that I'm ready to live under a lower standard of living, but in a free Palestine, rather than living under a high standard of living under occupation. My dignity has a price, and therefore we are here for food for our people, for work, for jobs, but for freedom and justice.
That was Palestine's Prime Minister, Mohammed Shtayyeh, in an interview with RT's Paul Slyer. Abdullah Abdullah, a presidential candidate in Afghanistan who claimed victory in the presidential elections in a meeting with Nancy Pelosi, said the conditions must be created for a U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan. He made the comments to RT's Afshan Ratanzi on his program, Going Underground.
To the USA's longest war, and whether Trump, unlike his predecessors, is the man to finally end it. The possibly imminent next president of Afghanistan, Dr. Abdullah Abdullah, joins me now from Kabul. Thanks so much for coming on the show, Dr. Abdullah. I've got to just begin by saying there are British and American soldiers in Afghanistan. Is it time for them to go home?
Thank you, first of all. And the troops, the international troops, including U.S. troops, are here for a reason. And they were here, they have been here for a reason in the past 18 years. That's the presence of Al-Qaeda, terrorist networks, now Daesh, and also the continuation of the war. I think the efforts on facilitating peace should be expedited. And that's what the Afghans want, and majority of our people want. And once there is peace, there will be no need for international troops in the country.
2,000 fewer soldiers this year from the United States. Mark Esper, Defense Secretary, saying there will be fewer. And now we have reports from the former Pentagon boss, Mad Dog Mattis's former speechwriter, Commander Snodgrass. Trump said, seriously, who gives a about Afghanistan? What did you make of that?
I'm not here to judge the conversations which has taken place somewhere else, but I can say that it was in 2001, 9/11, that 3,000 American people were killed in a tragedy by Al-Qaeda, emanating, unfortunately, from Afghanistan, supported at that time by the Taliban. And that's why the international troops are here. And we are fighting a common enemy together. And had it not been for the threat to U.S. homeland security, the U.S. troops wouldn't have been here.
Of course, I was speaking in the context of the withdrawal of U.S. troops from Syria. People watching will be saying, Al-Qaeda, those people were Saudi nationals, obviously previously supported by the United States. But tell me about what happened when you met with House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, because she was reported in the Amazon Washington Post as saying to you, if Trump won't lead on Afghanistan, she would. What was the meeting like?
The meeting with the House Speaker, Madam Pelosi, and also other chairpersons of the committees of the Congress, of the U.S. Congress. It was on in a partnership spirit, and lots of concerns were raised, and common concerns on both sides, on the possibility of peace in the country, on the impact of troop reduction in the country, and on the outcome of the elections and different possibilities and different scenarios, whether there will be a threat to U.S. homeland security from Afghanistan as a result of abrupt U.S. withdrawal. And I should say that it was a completely bipartisan delegations. Nevertheless, all of them were of the view that the U.S. should stay committed in support of the peace process in the country, and also we should work together in order to facilitate and create an environment so there will be no need for the presence of the U.S. troops in the country in the future. So one of the main questions there was that what will happen to the achievements of the Afghan people in the sacrifices which the Afghan people have made for achieving their rights, which of course all of us were of the view that those are hard-earned achievements, including the democratic process, and has to be preserved under any circumstances. But we need to, as Afghans, facilitate and create a situation and an environment that we could live together at peace with the Taliban while maintaining our differences. We have made efforts in the past and we will continue to do so in the future.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.